You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 7th of August 2017 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Tom Edwards. On today's programme...
This was a gut punch to North Korea today. They can either now take heed and say, okay, let's start being responsible and let's see another avenue, or they can continue what they're doing and the international community will continue to respond.
The United States Ambassador to the United Nations, Nikki Haley, there speaking to CNN after the unanimous vote approving new sanctions on North Korea. My guests today, Jane Kinnamont and James Boyes, will be discussing this and the day's other top stories, including reports that US Vice President Mike Pence might be part of a shadow campaign to run in 2020, Israel's plans to ban Al Jazeera from operating in the country, and why there are still so many fewer female heads of state than men. That's all to come over the next 30 minutes on Midori House with me, Tom Edwards, right here on Monocle 24. Yes, a very warm welcome to this Monday edition of Midori House. My guests today are indeed Jane Kinnamont and James Boyes. Jane's the Deputy Head of the Middle East and North Africa Programme at Chatham House. And James Boyes is a political historian specialising in the United States and its place in the world. Welcome both to Studio One. Very good to have you, with us. Let's start today's programme with a look at North Korea. Over the weekend, the UN United Nations Security Council passed a resolution imposing new sanctions on Pyongyang over its nuclear weapons programme. It passed unanimously. James Boyes, some saying these are the strongest sanctions ever imposed in response to a ballistic missile test. And maybe we'll consider North Korea and the specifics of that in a moment. But is this an example of the US getting foreign policy done? Because people have been saying, look, this is all going to grind to a halt under Trump. What do you make of it?
Well, there's several things. First of all, getting the UN to agree to anything unanimously is very, very difficult. Getting the Chinese, the Americans and the Russians to agree on something with regard to North Korea is impressive. So I think we have to recognise that. It's very, very easy to lambast the United States under Donald Trump, and heaven knows I've done that enough. Nikki Haley is emerging, I think, as quite a star. We're going to be talking about an interesting development about what might be happening in 4 years' time, and she's certainly someone who a lot of people are touting as a potential first American female president. I think what you're seeing here is a difference between, you know, quiet, calm negotiations behind the scenes. And what you might think of as, I was going to call it megaphone diplomacy that Donald Trump's involved in, but it's not even that discreet on occasion, let's be honest about it.
Not actually much diplomacy.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think what you're seeing is, you know, the permanent staff that are, you know, within the United States in the bureaucracy, fronted by Nikki Haley, coming through and working the back channels effectively at the UN to get, you know, a sweeping resolution, which, you know, let's be honest, it bans the export of oil, iron, coal, iron ore, lead, seafood. It basically limits the amount of North Koreans who can go and work abroad. It's really putting the squeeze on the Korean authorities. But let's not kid ourselves, you know, this country's been under UN sanctions since 2006, and we're still here talking about nuclear development.
And Jane, this is the problem, isn't it? That we may well herald certainly the work of Nikki Haley, and we can say, oh, this is good that there seems to be some sort of unanimity, you know, in the UN, even under the a Trump regime in the US. But will this actually make a real difference in practice? Or in a sense, should we expect Pyongyang to be, I don't know, even more bellicose going forwards?
There are not too many success stories of sanctions working, and where they have worked, such as with the recent Iran nuclear deal, that was in a case where the Iranian political system was at least more open compared to North Korea's. There were genuine internal divisions of opinion over how important the nuclear programme was, and there was a chance to change the guard with the politicians. North Korea's internal politics are pretty difficult for anyone to read, but they are very, very tightly controlled and very static. And of course, it's a regime that will be telling its people how resilient it is to sanctions, if indeed it lets its people hear about the news at all. Nonetheless, it does send a very strong signal, especially that China has been involved here. And you might not hear the word Trump is right too often on Monocle, but you know, Trump's recent focus on China as the main country with the power to influence North Korea is correct. And he is ramping up the pressure on them.
And James, what about this idea, though, that as effective or as these sanctions may be, ultimately, you know, you do need to talk. I mean, I guess the Iran talks are another example of that. But Tillerson said, I think this morning, the Secretary of State, that North Korea must stop all ballistic missile testing as a precursor to any talks. But, you know, is there even an appetite, do you think, for talks in Pyongyang? I mean, Jane's quite right. It's hard to second guess. But talks surely in the end have to follow. But they seem a long way. That idea seems a long way off, doesn't it?
Yeah. And again, what's fascinating, I think, is the distinction you're getting within this administration. You know, you're getting the likes of Nikki Haley and Tillerson, you know, at the UN and the State Department, you know, saying effectively the right things. You know, let's talk, let's negotiate, let's bring together, you know, multilateral approach, et cetera, et cetera. Whereas obviously Trump is saying something very, very different. So it's difficult to get a feed on exactly where the direction of policy is. But I guess we have to look at actually what's coming through in terms of what's measurable. We have got this sanctions regime in place. As Jane rightly points out, the problem with that, though, is it makes great headlines. But if you actually go back and look at how effective sanctions regimes have been in the past, you know, what usually ends up happening almost inevitably is the people at the very, very top keep doing fine, and the people at the very, very bottom in society get squeezed. And all too often, you can see, you know, the internal propaganda whipped up against, you know, the oppressor from outside, effectively saying, "Look, this is terrible," and you end up getting a galvanized support for the regime instead of leading to regime change, which, of course, is what the West thinks it's going to do.
And Jane, I mean, this is a key point, isn't it? That North Korea's reacted already, and I guess predictable rhetoric talking about, you know, thousandfold revenge for this outrage and so on and so forth. What can we expect, though, if we look at North Korea? And is James right that sadly the only thing that we can be sure about is that it may be unclear who the winners are from these developments, but we sure know who the losers are going to be, and it's going to be the people in North Korea. Mm-hmm.
There will be things that the regime wants, and it seems most likely to me, though not being an expert in North Korea, that they will want the rest of the world to stop supporting regime change in North Korea. They will see themselves as a regime that's unfairly besieged. And there are precedents for other countries, Libya for a while, Iran, basically trading concessions on a nuclear programme for acceptability. That might just be something that they are hoping for, but that's also not too good for the normal people.
I think one of the problems the United States has traditionally faced is the concept that, you know, it struggles, I think, sometimes to recognise a singular truth, which is that you don't negotiate with your friends, you have to negotiate with your enemies. And I think it's something which, I hate to say it, the right in America, the conservative base, seem to have a real struggle with in the last generation or so, I think. I think Obama got it. I think he came under a lot of attack for it, and you've seen the pushback against the Iran deal. But, you know, we've been here with the Koreans before in the late 90s, in Bill Clinton's second term, for example, Madeleine Albright, when she was Secretary of State, you know, said basically, look, you know, we're in a position, we'll talk, you know, we want to basically get an agreement here. They thought they had an agreement with regard to preventing nuclear proliferation and with regard to nuclear reactors at that point. It turns out the North Koreans were basically pulling a fast one and set back US-Korean negotiations for quite a way, I think. And so this idea of a complete lack of trust is something which comes up. And one is reminded once again of Ronald Reagan's famous adage, which is, you know, trust but verify, I think, when it comes to negotiation.
Indeed. Well, let's look a little bit at the conservative right in the States. We're turning our focus to a story from the New York Times claiming that a shadow campaign for 2020 is currently underway, under the assumption in the Times that Donald Trump will not seek a second term, which we can talk about. Some prominent Republicans, including apparently Vice President Mike Pence, are getting ready for the next election, or at least, James, the New York Times would have us believe. Now, to a degree, this is not, it's far from unimaginable. It's perfectly possible, isn't it, that Pence and others are discussing next steps. What do you read into this story in particular? And is it a safe assumption that the GOP probably is having these kinds of conversations?
To be honest, we could talk about this quite a long time because there's an awful lot here. First of all, let's be straight up. Pence has denied this straight up very, very quickly and unequivocally. where are we? Donald Trump has repeatedly said he expects to serve for 8 years. He's 71. He's no spring chicken. So, you know, we have to recognise the fact that he might not survive just in terms of his age, quite frankly. So there's that. He's obviously under great political pressure. I think any president who was hovering around 33% in the polls 6 months in, you'd have to look at it and go, this guy isn't doing particularly well. You would expect, therefore, for potential challenges. For members of his own party to come out this quickly to be challenging him is remarkable, I think. But it also speaks to the fact that fundamentally this guy is not a Republican and he's not a conservative. He hijacked the movement to take over the party and, against everybody's expectations, mine included, won. So it shouldn't be any surprise that people like Governor Kasich, who has not been a strong supporter, and don't forget, didn't even attend the convention when it was held in his home state last summer, are eyeing up the idea that this could, you know, be a one-term president. I would caution, however, that historically, Americans like to vote for 2 terms for each administration, 2 terms Republican, 2 terms for the Democrats. And the only time in modern history where that has not happened is when an incumbent president has to fight a rearguard action for his own party's nomination, which is what the Republicans are talking about openly here. If you end up doing that, the likelihood is you basically buck the historical trend and you'd get a Democrat elected.
Jane, it is interesting, isn't it? I mean, people constantly been looking for signs that the GOP is going to abandon Trump, or, you know, turn on their own and put their, you know, the party interests, I guess, ahead of his. I mean, would it be incorrect to look at this and say, you know, there must be people in the GOP who are realising that he is doing harm? And if they ally that to the point that James raises there, I think quite correctly, that Trump isn't really a Republican per se, we should expect more manoeuvrings of this type, even before the midterms, which, of course, if Trump fares very badly, could sort of drive this narrative on it yet further.
Sure. Well, plenty of the Republican grandees were denouncing Trump, you know, during the election and have only needed to cozy up to him because he has become the president. It's possible, given all the investigations around Russia and so forth, that he could even be a less than one-term president. And so one might forgive Mike Pence for possibly having House of Cards-style dreams from time to time. But after Trump, whether that's in 2 years, 4 years, 8 years, the US in general seems likely to be extremely politically polarised. It was politically polarised after Obama, but the current trend is becoming even more so. So whoever is thinking about being the next leader will probably need a more centrist agenda, something that's quite difficult to advance under the current president.
Well, and also quite difficult to advance if we think of Mike Pence, who's far from a centrist, Jane. I mean, is he going to be sort of, I don't know, even hypothetically, let's say he is standing in 2020, sort of tarnished by association, or simply not enough of a unity candidate to bring these disparate parts of the GOP back together?
Let's be frank here. It's I would say, as close to impossible as I can imagine for a sitting vice president to openly challenge his president. You know, this isn't House of Cards, you know. That's an interesting show,
but it's much crazier than that.
Absolutely. We need to see what happens in the midterms. Let's be frank.
Is that going to be as critical? Because obviously we've talked about this before. I mean, that does seem to be a pivotal moment.
I'll tell you why it's going to be pivotal. The I word is obviously being bandied about already with regard to Trump. The Republicans will not vote to impeach their own president. But if the Democrats win control of the House, they own, you know, the procedure effectively. Now, the chances of the Democrats controlling the House and the Senate after this election, I think, are minimal. But they could very well begin the process. You could impeach and move to the Senate, and then you would get almost certainly being found not guilty, as has happened the only 2 times this has happened in U.S. history. But the idea that you could severely weaken Donald Trump that way is interesting. I mean, personally, I think the best thing the Democrats could do is basically just let this roll out, because Donald Trump is proving day in, day out his ineffectualness as a chief executive. Mike Pence, on the other hand, I think if he were president, he'd have a far better understanding of how Congress works and would be more tied in with the Republican conservative base. But Donald Trump's got this sort of support in the heartland, and you notice he keeps going back to the same places. He likes this echo chamber of hearing his faithful crowds out there. But as long as those figures keep hovering around the low 30s, you know, he and the party are in trouble in the midterms. If they don't pick up, they could well be in trouble in 2020. The only thing that's saving him it must be said, is the absolute lack of any unity in the Democratic Party or any obvious frontrunner to challenge him in 3.5 years' time.
Well, and that was the question I was going to pose to you, Jane, next, which is that presumably, yeah, whether we look to the left or right of the political spectrum in the States, we talk about the need for that more centrist, a unity candidate. I mean, James is right. We don't see that coming from the Democrat side, though, either, which presumably would make the incumbent president's job, if he does survive till 2020, that much easier.
Sure, I think we're basically seeing a period of lamentation and disbelief and grief in the Democratic Party, and still a failure to get to grips with why people voted for Trump and what those people might need from other politicians in future.
Well, we might talk about one of the motivations behind people voting for Trump a little bit later. But James, just finally on the, on this point, as you mentioned, it's of course unsurprising that Pence immediately dismissed the claims. When we talked about it as a sort of shadow campaign, in a sense, on Capitol Hill, it's not going to be in the shadows, is it? It's going to be fairly brazen. Aren't people having this conversation, I don't know, in a fairly forthright and open way in the GOP?
Well, the fact that it's in the Times is clearly something that's being spoken about. There's no love lost between the Republican Party establishment, the RNC, and Donald Trump. The biggest risk to Donald Trump's presidency is ultimately Donald Trump. And what's fascinating about the way he tweets, if you notice, he doesn't talk about we when he talks about the Republican Party. He talks about they. He's distancing himself constantly from the RNC. He did this not only figuratively, but literally. He brought Rance Priebus in, who basically chaired the RNC effectively to run the White House, along with Sean Spicer, directly from the RNC. He's fired both of them within the first 200 days. So he's jettisoning the personnel from the RNC, the ideological ties with the Republican Party. This is going to be a major problem, though, because, of course, you know, he might well need these people for political support and political survival in the near future. And if he has divorced himself from them and become effectively an independent president, loathed by the left, alienated from the right, he could find himself very much adrift without a lifeboat.
Excellent. James, thanks for that. We're going to take a short break now on Midori House. When we come back after this, why Israel wants to ban Al Jazeera. Stay tuned.
Monocle has bureau around the world, in Tokyo, Hong Kong, Singapore, London, Toronto, and New York City. In Hong Kong, our bureau chief is James Chambers.
There's no such thing as an ordinary day in Hong Kong. On any one day, I may be interviewing a city mayor or having coffee with a hotelier or chatting with an interior designer and then trying out the latest bar or restaurant. And mixed in with all of this, there'll be some wacky or outrageous news coming out of China which deserves to be covered on the radio. So it's this variety that I really love about the job.
Hear from Monocle's editors and correspondents on the stories that matter and the places that matter every day on Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. I'm Tom Edwards. Still with me, Jane Kinnamont and James Boyes. Now, Israel's government has moved to close Al Jazeera's offices in the country, joining a boycott by Jordan, Egypt, the UAE and Saudi Arabia, which have all accused the network of sponsoring terrorism, in effect. Jane Kinnamont, maybe you can put this into some kind of context for us. We've talked about the travails of Al Jazeera and the kind of weird soft power battle that it's engaged in. How does sort of Israel's interest in that narrative, how does that fit into the bigger picture, which has obviously been unfolding over the past few weeks?
Israel's never been a fan of Al Jazeera, but the very fact that Al Jazeera has had a presence there marks it out from most other Gulf channels who've traditionally boycotted Israel. Al Jazeera does have a record of interviewing Israeli officials, although it will always put things, you know, in extremely critical terms. What's really fascinating here is that this isn't something led by Israel or led by the US. This is Israel following the lead of Saudi Arabia and the UAE, arguably becoming more like its Arab neighbours when it comes to issues of freedom of speech. It's also an indication that Israel's relations with Arab governments, especially those in the Gulf, have been warming significantly for quite some years.
James, it's an interesting point, isn't it? This idea, you know, Al Jazeera's editor in Jerusalem has accused Benjamin Netanyahu of collusion with some of these, he says, sort of autocratic Arab neighbours. And he said, look, this is an attack on, you know, a free and independent media. okay, it's all getting rather personal, but how worried should we be about the media side of this, as well as this sort of broader political picture?
Yeah, I think we should be. I mean, ultimately, you know, Israel prides itself effectively as the democracy in the Middle East, effectively. You know, there is, you know, clearly an attempt with Netanyahu, I think, to present himself very much to westernize as almost like an Americanized figure in this part. That, you know, he studied there. He's very, very close with Donald Trump, for example. I wonder whether that might be have something to do with this, of course, because Donald Trump's whipped this up with regard to Qatar very nicely, effectively, in the last couple of weeks. So I don't think we need to to ignore that side of things. But this idea fundamentally that you've got, you know, Israel coming down and trying to ban a network like this, I think is very, very troubling, you know, whatever one makes of the politics of it.
Jane, what do you think that the Al Jazeera play is going to be going forward? Because it looks rather difficult to imagine, you know, sort of easy steps that the network certainly can make, because it's embroiled in this obviously this sort of broader proxy conflict. What do you think the discussions will look like, even if we look inside Al Jazeera?
It's on a huge PR offensive at the moment, and I think, to be honest, the focus on Al Jazeera has been really good for Qatar. It's allowed it to really brush aside some of the criticisms of possibly financing dodgy groups in Syria and elsewhere, and present this Gulf conflict as an issue of human rights and freedom of speech. They recently hosted a major human rights conference in Doha, took all the delegates to visit Al Jazeera, had them pose for photo ops, all this kind of thing. Nonetheless, there will probably be some discussions about what compromises they might make. Last time Qatar fell out with its neighbours back in 2014, Al Jazeera was basically told, don't have anybody from Saudi Arabia who's critical of the government for a while. And they'll probably do something like that on a much bigger scale. You won't see the networks shut down, but you will see probably staff changes. However, the more overt pressure that's put on them, the less able they'll be able to do that very openly and very quickly.
But it definitely seems different even from 2014 this time around. Do you think that there is a more concerted front? And how much did the involvement of Trump, and obviously we know the pronouncements he made about Qatar, how much did that, do you think, ease the path for the rest of this sort of broad brush alliance to really round on Qatar and make these specific demands, which do seem more aggressive even than before?
It's very much to do with leadership changes both in the US and in Saudi Arabia. This approach to Qatar wouldn't have happened under King Abdullah. There are many reports that the recently overthrown Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia was himself against the boycott of Qatar, and that was one of the things that precipitated his downfall. So actually quite a small number of personalities in the US and in the Middle East are responsible for this escalation, which has, of course, much bigger geopolitical implications.
And Joe, it's interesting. We were reflecting earlier about, you know, the effectiveness or the future of the short term of American foreign policy. And obviously, if we look at this Qatari, the pronouncements from Trump, you know, they seem to be rather at odds with things that Tillerson was saying or briefing at the same time. Is this an example where, you know, some of these other countries, these Gulf allies, have been emboldened by, well, Trump doing his classic, you know, talking off the cuff?
I think so. I think that what he has done, probably out of ignorance, if I'm very honest, is given voice to this remit to go after Qatar like this. I should add, just as a little footnote, though, that, you know, we're talking about Israel here and basically accusing them of drumming out, the Al Jazeera organization. But of course, Al Jazeera America attempted to launch a couple of years ago when they took over Al Gore's current TV network. And they very, very quickly found themselves frozen out of a whole host of regional satellite organizations who just refused to carry it because this idea that they were Bin Laden's network of choice, effectively. So I guess there's more than one way to skin a cat. It's just that maybe Israel had been a bit more upfront and open about it than the Americans were.
And do you think it's just a sense, Jane, where, you know, Israel's interests sort of actually happen to kind of broadly overlap with their Gulf neighbours? They're not actually sort of colluding, or are they following the lead? Or is it just a sort of a quirk of fate where serendipitously their interests happen to align in the short term?
I think there's now quite a close alignment of interests between Israel and the UAE in particular. They both regard the Muslim Brotherhood and Iran as the twin threats to the region. They share a whole bunch of common goals when it comes to the way forward for the Palestinian territories, and particularly trying to weaken Hamas, which has been funded for some years largely by Qatar. So it is something that's deeper and more geopolitical. But specifically on the media side, does represent a change for Israel, which for a country in conflict has been very open to free press and to giving access to journalists.
And just on the point about Trump and foreign policy, and obviously he made a number of pronouncements during the campaign and when he successfully got into office about how, oh, well, I'm going to take a look at the Middle East and don't worry. And then he said this extraordinary thing about, hey, if a one-state solution is better, that's fine by me if it's good for them. He's not going to get any more involved, is he? And if anything, these pronouncements on Qatar, would they have scared him off a bit from other pronouncements?
I think so. I think he's tweeted loudly on Qatar because it has suited him to show some apparent results from his anti-terrorism push in the Middle East. But you see that the rest of the US machinery of state follows up in an entirely different way. The US has just signed a new memorandum of understanding on cooperation on counter-terrorism with Qatar and, of course, a major arms deal.
And finally, on today's programme, let's ask a question about our leadership, not just about Trump, but why do all these leaders look the same? The issue of women being underrepresented in government, in presidential roles, is not new. But in 2017, most of the world's countries have still never had a female leader. In fact, the latest figures by the Interparliamentary Union says that 78% of parliamentary seats are filled by men, an even higher rate of government posts, some 83%. Are likewise filled by men. Jane, it's not the first time we've talked about this, but I don't know, I just find these figures incredibly depressing. Is there any solace? Can we say, well, at least it's not 100%? Can we find any sort of positive rays of light in this?
These figures used to be even worse. Of course, some countries have moved forward through quotas, which haven't always meant a meaningful increase in representation for women. But there has been a broadly positive trend in at least some countries. And if you look across the Middle East and Africa, some of the places where representation of women is the weakest, there is such a sea change in the education levels of women right across those regions that I am hopeful things will need to change.
So do you think it's more important to look at things like education if we say look at the continent of Africa rather than the fact that when Ellen Johnson Sirleaf goes, there will be no head of state who's a woman, in all of the countries of Africa?
It's complex. I think you do need to look at education and employment to look at women's representation in society as a whole. I think that can actually be more important even than a female head of state or female ministers, because you can have countries where you have a few elite women in power who actually change very little for the majority of women.
James, it's hard not to ask you for your view on the US. Obviously, many of us were expecting the first female president if we go back to 2016. But here's a question for you. If you and I travelled back in a time machine to, I don't know, 1960, for example, and I had put the question to you, will the US have a female president or a black president first? I don't know. I would have imagined many people would say, hey, look at the state of civil rights in this country and equality. I'm sure it would be a woman first. How much was good old-fashioned misogyny to blame, or partly to blame, for Hillary Clinton's defeat?
Yeah, I would agree with that. I also say, however, if you looked at the United States in 1960 and said, well, who would that woman be? It would be very difficult to identify. Coming into the 1970s, actually, one of the people who was touted as the first American female president even then was Hillary Rodham, who went on to become Hillary Clinton, it must be pointed out. How much did misogyny play in the downfall of Hillary Clinton? It's one of the key determining factors. Fascinatingly enough, you know, if you look at the breakdown in terms of gender voting patterns, Hillary Clinton just could not claw to her camp a greater degree of female support than any other Democratic candidate had. Donald Trump, despite his many outrageous statements, which would clearly you would have thought would have alienated a degree of the female population, that just didn't occur. You know, he managed to attract the same roughly percentage of female votes as Mitt Romney had done. One of the great problems for Hillary Clinton and for the Democrats basically is that the Democratic support is cloistered into basically three large clumps across the country and not spread out across the individual states, so that when the popular vote is counted, they win. But when you look at the Electoral College breakdown, as Donald Trump found out to his joy, they lose. So the direction of travel for the Democratic Party is difficult. For women in the United States, it's interesting. We have Nancy Pelosi, obviously, who's been Speaker of the House. We talked about Nikki Haley, for example, as a potential candidate in the future, currently UN ambassador. There's a senator out of California at the moment, who people are speaking of very highly for the Democrats potentially. But, you know, when you think about, you know, the demographic makeup of the country, women are not a minority, they're the majority, and yet they still struggle, I think, to break through to national politics and national prominence. It's quite depressing.
Quite depressing. I don't like to leave on a negative note, but there was no escaping it today. Those were the views of James Boyes. Jane Kinnamont, thanks for being with us as well. Thanks to Carlotta, Fernando, Amalia Ilgner, and our studio manager, Christy Evans, for bringing us today's programme. More music for you next, culture at 1900, and more on all the big stories of the day at 2200 on The Daily. Thanks for listening.